Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me today on the Class War Battlefield podcast. Please do me the honor of supporting this work that I am doing. I've been doing this work now for free on your behalf for, my God, 11 years. 5, 10, 20, 50. If you can afford it, please do. Cash at me at $CWB Podcast. CWB Podcast. Cash App it. CWB Podcast. Also, hit me up on PayPal. CWB Podcast. All the way across the board, y'all. Help me out. Thank you for donating and enjoy the show.
Definition. Well, howdy there, Internet people. It's Bo again. So tonight, we're going to talk about patriotism, specifically American patriotism, because patriotism means different things in different parts of the world. In the United States, the term has become muddled. It has been confused with another term, and they're not the same. And it's very easy to illustrate that they aren't the same, but it's uncomfortable for people to realize this at times. American patriotism started in the 1760s. However, using that period would take us away from our point, so we're going to use a different date. We're going to use 1776. I think that everybody would agree that American patriots existed in 1776. That goes without saying. Here's the thing. Those who fought at Yorktown, Lexington, Concord, not a single one of them held any loyalty whatsoever to the United States. None. It's an indisputable historical fact. None of them held any loyalty to the U.S. The reason is because it didn't exist. The United States didn't come into being until 1787, 1788 really. It's when it was ratified. When they spoke of patriotism, they didn't mean loyalty to a country the way we think of it. When they spoke of country, they meant the country, the countryside, those around them, the people, their neighbors. That's who they held loyalty to. An idea. A principle. That's what patriotism is. They held no loyalty to some politician, to some body of governance. They held no loyalty to D.C. It didn't exist. The United States didn't exist. The other thing that American patriots throughout our history have all shared is that they understood that governments in general, well, they're a child of the people, and sometimes children need to be corrected. That's what an American patriot is. Yeah, in 1776, it was the Tree of Liberty and all of that. More recently, it was I Have a Dream. Martin Luther King was a person who held his loyalty to the people, those around him, his neighbors. He understood that government was a child of the people, and he corrected it. As we evolve, we understand that violence is not necessary for everything, and that ideas travel faster than bullets. So when you hear people talk about patriotism, and their version is obeying the government, and doing whatever those in power say, they're not patriots. That's the opposite of patriotism. That's nationalism. And that's what the United States has fostered. It's the greatest trick the powers that be have pulled. They've tied your principles to their wishes. As we move forward over the next year, understand that when those in D.C. appeal to your patriotism to get you to sign away your rights, to give them a little bit more control, to do things you know are wrong and violate your principles, understand that's a lot like a child wanting to eat cake for dinner every night. You're the adult. Government is a child of the people. You are the adult. You get to decide. You have the power. The reason they are appealing to you is because you have the power. They need us. We don't need them. Anyway, it's just a thought. Y'all have a good night.
To a non-American, driving down roads lined with American flags, past people dressed like this, past fields where, hand on heart, Americans sing along to the national anthem for even the most forgotten Little League game, and past bars where a USA chant is on a hair trigger is all very strange. Every Ford commercial in this country is about how the US is sick as hell. Every bald eagle is swole. Every beer is a gun. And a kid just pledging allegiance to the flag is a heartwarming story on national television. In no other country in the world is there such a widespread emotional attachment to the symbols of a bureaucratic government structure. It's incredibly strange, but I get that a lot of patriotism is just having fun. For a lot of people, it's like wearing your team's colors to a game. It's a good time. The problem is that that's not all that patriotism, or its defense, is. Almost every week, I get an email calling me a traitor or anti-American scum. For some reason, in this country, good faith criticism almost always triggers this knee-jerk reaction that the person raising their concerns, or more often just advocating for their own self-determination, hates America. Let's take an example. Here's an email I got from someone who probably genuinely believes they love their country and thinks what they're doing is a justified defense. And you know what? Let's give this viewer the benefit of the doubt. If you wholeheartedly believe that someone hates you and or the place you call home, it's not entirely unreasonable to get angry with them like this. But here's the thing. If you really want to label yourself patriotic, this kind of approach is completely counterproductive. Think about it for a second. If you care about your country, you should be among the first to call out problems when you see them. If you love your country and your fellow Americans, you should want to fix those problems, not blindly defend them. This kind of behavior isn't patriotic. It's ignorant. All those quote-unquote traitors are doing is bringing attention to problems that all of us should want to solve. There's nothing un-American about caring for your unhoused neighbors. Nothing unreasonable about pointing out that our medical bills are the highest in the world and that we should work to lower them. It's not being a traitor to suggest that the United States is not living up to the standards it claims to set for itself and the rest of the world. And it's not un-American to identify that the root of the problem runs pretty deep. I think we can all agree that these problems exist. That's not the issue most of the time. The issue comes when someone suggests that the cause of these problems is structural and therefore requires structural change. A lot of these problems, these things that we can all agree are hurting people both in this country and beyond our borders, aren't just a matter of bad people. They are an integral part of the American experiment, going all the way back to the country's founding and the principles our economy is built on. And it's okay to point that out. The Constitution allows for amendments because it was written with the idea that things would change. And what was accepted by the Founding Fathers doesn't have to be accepted by us today. Just because the Constitution is still around doesn't mean that everything in it is good or works. It just means that it's a document that effectively protected its own existence. Fun fact, many of the Founding Fathers, who are always portrayed as dusty old dudes in History Channel documentaries, were actually in their 20s. You wouldn't want a constitution written by a bunch of frat boys to be immortal and unchangeable, would you? Okay, so hopefully I've made it clear that a better conception of patriotism would require a willingness to soberly assess and tackle our country's problems. With that, we've already broached the topic of what's called uncritical patriotism. But there's no reason we can't let go of patriotism entirely, and this video will make that claim for American patriotism specifically. Patriotism, especially here in the States, doesn't actually build genuine solidarity like the glorified image of patriotism might have you believe. It's not really about standing together in any meaningful way. Instead, patriotism in this country actually reinforces divisions along aesthetic lines convenient to those in power. It encourages exceptionalist thinking and xenophobia, with consequences neither good for the world nor for average Americans. And having been injected with anti-communist rhetoric during the Cold War, patriotism has become this loyalty to the myth that the US is the sole bastion of goodness and freedom in the world, which makes any claim that something might be wrong, unjust, and possible for us to change seem like a declaration of war. Let's talk about that. Patriotism is always promoted as solidarity. Behind the symbols, the territory, the language, the culture, whatever patriotism attaches itself to, its main draw isn't we all like these three colors, it's community and solidarity with other people. This idea that even people you've never met and will never meet are there for you and you're there for them. It's a nice idea, and said in this abstract way, there's nothing inherently wrong with it. But there are a couple problems with the reality of patriotic quote-unquote solidarity. For starters, it obviously doesn't extend to everyone, and patriotic solidarity specifically is weaponized for conservative ends. The political scientist Benedict Anderson puts it very clearly when he says, "Regardless of the actual inequality and exploitation that may prevail in each, the nation is always conceived as a deep, horizontal comradeship." And as you might expect, this is something that those who benefit from inequality and exploitation can use. If enough people can be convinced that unity along the lines of nationality is more important than pretty much anything else, then calling attention to all the internal conflicts within a society can be swept under the rug as dividing us. For patriots, unity is what makes the country proud and strong, so it's better not to point out how that unity is held together by one group oppressing another, or we might risk losing that unity. But obviously, not calling out oppression benefits the people doing the oppressing. Through the idea of the nation, people come to identify with their exploiters in a way that justifies their continued existence. For example, some people are proud that their country has more billionaires than other countries. For some reason, being born within a couple thousand miles of one another and within the same border gets people to identify with those who have hoarded more wealth than we can even understand. Most people share almost nothing in common with their country's billionaires, and almost everything with the average person in another country. But that feeling of pride gets them to disregard one set of differences and makes the smaller differences with foreigners seem a lot bigger. As a result, the exploitation that is necessary for billionaires to exist seems less important when we're told it's in the service of something we share, the greatness of America. Even though the greatness of America does almost nothing to make your life better, but billionaires getting tax cuts and skirting labor laws definitely makes it worse. This is something that's really apparent when conservative patriots talk about the experience of Black Americans, for example. In a recent interview, the conservative economist Glenn Lowry said, quote, "Look, here we are. We are African Americans, but we are Americans first. We are not African in any way that's meaningful. Yes, our ancestors may have been enslaved, but they were also emancipated. We are literally the richest and most powerful people of African descent on the entire planet. We have 10 times the income on average of the typical Nigerian. There's an enormous Black middle class and Black billionaires." The translation, pride in the existence of the possibility of Black success justifies the continued exploitation of the vast majority of Black people. If you are Black, you should be grateful to have the incredibly unlikely chance to have more money than you know what to do with instead of complaining that this system is rigged against you, and in a similar way, is rigged against other Black people in another country. By implying that Black Americans should prioritize their national affiliation rather than their class and race, Lowry is subtly implying that Black Americans should not be so critical of a system with a legal and policing system that targets and kills them disproportionately, that exploits their racial otherness to deny them a comfortable life unless they assimilate to the dominant white norms of behavior, and that Black Americans should distance themselves from people living in another country whose poverty can be explained, at least in part, by the same phenomenon of slavery that is at the root of the present inequality between Black and white people in America. The fact that other people have it worse turns rightful indignation into pride for those who can be convinced. and makes those who stay rightfully indignant look ungrateful. Lowry defends capitalism, and he knows that capitalism requires exploitation. He's just hoping that by calling attention to your nationality, you'll accept how exploited you are because someone else has it worse. A non-patriotic approach might look at the inequality between Black Americans and Black Nigerians and find that the plunder of Africa through colonialism and slavery caused both the present inequality between white and Black Americans and the inequality between Americans and Nigerians. And from there, can ask what should be done to rectify this injustice, and what structures are keeping it in place. By contrast, a patriotic approach to these facts gets people to think that the best we can do is protect what we have. Never try to get more. Never question the nature of the system as it exists today. And never hope to achieve justice, especially for those not part of the patriotic community. At the end of the day, the existence of Black billionaires still relies on the exploitation of Black people, and is still supported by the systemic discrimination of Black people. But drown all that in a little American pride, and it goes down a lot smoother. To recap, patriotism replaces solidarity among people who suffer under the same structures of injustice, in this case international racial capitalism, and replaces it with solidarity between those who do the oppressing and those who are oppressed. Let me seriously ask, what is the point of patriotism? Why choose to believe you're better or even meaningfully different from someone on the other side of the world? Your material concerns are the same. You have bills, you want to take care of your family, you want the freedom to pursue your own happiness. There is far more in common between you than the differences created by a borderline decided hundreds of years ago in random wars and brutal, bloody conquests. The world is not going to be made better as long as the oppressed fight one another for the crumbs dropped from the table of the oppressors. Moving on. For patriotism to work, you need to have a general idea about what it is you're patriotic about. And this is one of the great debates of American politics. What is the soul of America? Generally, a patriot might answer with something like freedom, opportunity, or justice. And if that's you, those are good things to defend and give value to. I'm right there with you, 100%. But there is no reason that you need to attach those things exclusively to the US. Absolutely defend freedom. Absolutely defend justice. Absolutely defend opportunity. But why connect those things to this vague idea you'll have to defend too? Because both historically and presently, while American political discourse likes to promote these ideas of freedom and justice, American political action and the structures of American politics and the American economy actively work against these things. I'm not going to rehash all of American history to make this point. Suffice it to say that slavery, manifest destiny, meaning the still ongoing genocide of Native Americans, and the various imperial wars the US has led, are all cases where the nation's first goal and economic motivation was suppressing the freedom of people categorized as others, and therefore outside the mythologized community. Defending something like freedom within the context of American patriotism has rarely ever meant actually defending freedom. And it's almost always meant taking it away from those who were in the way of a greater project of wealth accumulation. And I can already hear a commenter saying something like, if the US can be blamed for, say, Jim Crow, then it should also be praised for the civil rights movement. But I'd argue you'd have a really difficult time defining something as America and showing it was on the right side of the civil rights movement. For example, if America to you means the community of people living in this country, the majority opinion of the US was decidedly against the civil rights movement, with the press calling its leaders like MLK and Malcolm X un-American. If America means the government of this country, then it too was decidedly against the civil rights movement, sending police to crush the protests. If America means the country's founding documents, civil rights for Black people is clearly not what America is all about. When it comes to justice, freedom, and opportunity, these things were not achieved for millions of people by being patriotic, but by working outside of and rejecting what was considered American at their time. If you understand why flying the Confederate flag sends a specific message, regardless of the values people who fly it say it represents, consider how the same things might apply to the American flag. Retroactively, historical moments like the civil rights movement have been folded into the America that one should be patriotic for. But that doesn't mean that freedom isn't still being suppressed in the name of patriotism. When movements for self-determination like BLM and the decolonization movement make waves, for example, the knee-jerk reaction against people wanting a more free society, free for everyone to build their own lives without the threat and exercise of state violence against them, is time and time again patriotism. BLM, and decolonization proponents are ruthlessly attacked by an angry mob mobilized not against their ideas, but by the "They Hate America" slogan repeated endlessly on conservative media. These movements are indeed contesting the hegemonic idea of what America is right now, but they are clearly defending the values American patriots claim to hold: freedom, justice, and opportunity. Finally, we should talk about how anti-communism is a core pillar of American patriotism. Part of the reactionary nature of American patriotism can be explained by the long-standing myths that have surrounded the relationship of the American public with socialist ideas. When movements for justice are called anti-American, they're usually also called Marxist or communist pejoratively. And when movements like the civil rights movement are repackaged into the American patriotic canon, their radicality and the socialist politics of their leaders like MLK are either outright erased or hotly contested, with some even going so far as to say that if MLK was alive today, he'd be a conservative Republican. Two myths inform this idea. One, that America is ontologically capitalist, meaning that it is in the nature of the United States to be a capitalist nation, rather than the more realistic idea that economic systems come and go, and just because the US has a capitalist economy right now doesn't mean it will forever. And two, that capitalism is the only thing that works, and socialism always fails. The second claim is clearly a myth because this isn't what I would call working, and historically, American foreign policy has been intent on crushing socialism rather than letting it fail on its own like the pro-capitalists claim it will. In this country, anti-communism has been something we've nurtured for a long time, with things like the Immigration Acts of 1903 and 1918, which enabled the government to deport foreign-born anarchists, communists, and labor organizers, the successive Red Scares during the 20th century, and obviously the Cold War. The notion that anti-communism is patriotic is a really well-established one. The result is that, when combined with capitalist realism, this idea of a resolutely anti-communist, ontologically capitalist America makes it seem like there is no alternative, and anyone proposing anything that would clearly improve your life, if they're doing so by challenging a capitalist norm, might be ruining the only thing that we know works, even if it clearly hasn't been working for a long time now. Patriotism, like capitalist realism, really limits our imagination. When people come up with good ideas about how to change things for the better, if we keep calling them un-American and shooting them down right away, this country won't get any better for the vast majority of the people living both inside and outside its borders. And just to be clear before the video ends, this whole video isn't me coming after you for being American, if you are. There's obviously nothing wrong with just being from here. All I'm saying is that it doesn't make a huge amount of sense to be proud of this vague mythology that is at best a mixed bag. And insisting that everyone here be proud of it only makes it harder for us to change the parts we all agree are bad. Constantly thinking in terms of nation-states like this is really blinding us to the fact that we have a lot more to gain by building solidarity everywhere, all over the world, not just within our own arbitrary borders. Let's let go of patriotism in favor of genuine solidarity.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I am your brother, Vimer Dees Okaya. And welcome to this episode of the Class War Battlefield Podcast. American patriotism. You just heard. From one of my favorite channels on YouTube, titled Second Thought. That's the channel. And the video you just heard the clip from is, why is American patriotism so weird? I over the last 15 years, have really sought to, you know, think about this and understand it. Why is American patriotism so weird? I discovered a book, and I believe I discovered it while reading, listening to, technically, Rick Perlstein's just absolutely stunning book, The Invisible Bridge. And the book is titled, and I'm actually looking at my my bookshelf right now. I moved a bunch of books, and I think I moved this one because I can't see it. But it the title is something like Americanism, the world's fourth great religion, or something like that. And I actually think that that is a stupendous way. And I'm sorry, not a stupendous way. I think it's a fabulous, wonderful way of looking at patriotism. Patriotism is a religion. It's also a declaration. And the reason American patriotism, I believe, is so fundamentalist, because it is fundamentalist, and I know there's many different concepts of patriotism, and I think that those different types of American patriotism have it holds some valor. But if you really honestly look over the course of the last couple hundred years in America, in the United States specifically of America, and you dig into the types of patriotism, very few of those types of patriotism, especially the ones that were mainly popular throughout the colonies, and then what would become the 13 original states, and then, you know, the territories that were added. The patriotism that was most famous and most popular was not dedicated to equality. It wasn't dedicated to justice. It wasn't dedicated to a type of egalitarian fraternity that a lot of people like to believe it was. Heck, it wasn't dedicated to democracy. It was dedicated to a republicanism that had representative constructs innate in the institutions, but democracy was understood to be this sort of blanket cover for republicanism, which, you know, I've talked about before. In addition to that, patriotism was dedicated to an idea of not only what America was, but what it would always be, and how that vision impacted each and every individual. One of the things that I did prior to the pandemic, and then I dug deeper into it during the pandemic, was I listened to probably 2.5-3 dozen books that were written in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And the type of picture that was painted by these books, some of which were written by Europeans who had come to the United States and studied there and lived there for a significant period of time, and then went back to Europe and wrote these books. All of them were fiction, but they were built along premises of what America was. Some of the books were from Americans who grew up here and who either had what one might call conservative leanings, which it was funny to see the difference in their conservatism, or even liberal radical, or liberal or radical leanings, and the types of stories that they told. One thing, though, that was not often disputed between the different groups was what patriotism meant. Patriotism was this religious fervor that sought to bind the individual to a future that was yet to come, but was promised as long as you did what it took to get there. And here's the funny thing is, how many of you have ever talked to a right-wing person who says, you have no clue what I sacrificed, what my cousin sacrificed, what my uncle sacrificed, my granddad and my great-granddad, all of them sacrificed something, okay? You didn't understand the significance of that. Years back, I found a book on chivalry. I was, before the pandemic, I was down at one of my favorite coffee spots, and I'm not joking, this is not the beginning of a joke, two priests walked in. Actually, technically, I think one of them was a monk and the other one was a priest. They were dressed differently. And they were talking about chivalry and what it meant. And they didn't spill details, but they mentioned an author. And all they mentioned was the last name. And I spent literally the next year searching the internet trying to find that book. I found that book. Unfortunately, I don't remember the title of it right now. I think I still have it. One of my thumbnails crashed 2 years ago, and a number of really important documents and PDF files went with it. And I haven't been able to remember a lot of them, so it's not a happy day for that one. But it is what it is. Anyway, when I found the book, I'll be honest with you, the first few chapters were a bore. I was like, okay, what the, come on, man, this is nuts. There ain't really nothing here. This is kind of like, you know, water thin, and that's doing a disservice to water. This is just not, I don't understand what they're talking about. Then I got to like chapter 4, chapter 5, and at the end of the chapter was a list of properties and principles of chivalry. And that's when it made sense. In those properties and principles were what I believe were the foundation for what we call American patriotism. In fact, many of you may not realize this, but way back, you know, 120, 30, 40 years ago, there was an idea of this Southern chivalry and Western chivalry. In fact, when you watch a lot of these old black and white Westerners, there is a code of conduct, which often didn't exist how they say it existed, but that code of conduct is built off of chivalry. It is an old way of treating women. It's an old way of treating men. And it's an old way of treating the institutions, which may not be prevalent or may not be present at the moment, but the spirit of those institutions touch every man, woman, and child. And it is their duty to carry out the spirit associated with those institutions when those institutions aren't there. This was in that list. And in fact, the next chapter, in the chapter where those principles were listed, really started developing my ideas of, you know, okay, so chivalry is really this thing that comes from old Renaissance or pre-Renaissance Europe. And the crazy thing with chivalry is there is always a need to protect the nobles and the wealthy and the people at the top of the society. It goes without saying. It goes without saying. In fact, conservatism, when you start to dig into chivalry, conservatism has a real prominent role, especially the type of conservatism that prevents progressivism, that prevents the natural inclination of humanity to skew and move ever so slowly, sometimes quickly, towards what we think of as democracy, what we think of as equality. The goal of the chivalrous ones is to interrupt that natural flow, to destroy it if possible. And in fact, when we think about the Crusades, when we think about the Crusades and the religious undertone, all of that is somewhat attributable to the chivalrous concept. Patriotism takes this, and instead of saying you need to protect the king, the queen, the royal family, the court, the nobles, it says you need to protect the homeland. You need to protect the institutions that keep the homeland safe. You need to protect those things that are authoritative in your life. And if you can't, then you are a traitor to the cause. Well, what's the cause? You look at chivalry, and the cause is built on the royal family. The royal family, a stable royal family means a stable kingdom. Many patriots believe that if you make the lives of the wealthiest in this country stable, they will in turn stabilize the country. Now, the patriot doesn't care how it's done, as long as they are rewarded for what they've done and their loyalty. This is why so many conservatives get hurt. I mean, emotionally hurt when they feel like, or when they see, and they can't escape it, that the party that they've been supporting, or the wealthy people they've been supporting, are actually doing harm to them. I mean, we often talk about, in this country, oh, well, people are just brainwashed. They're just brainwashed. They're just brainwashed. Ladies and gentlemen, what if it's not just that they're brainwashed? What if they're susceptible to being brainwashed because they believe in something that is older than themselves? War for Eternity, the book written by, and I had the name and I don't have it anymore. Sorry about that. But in that book, War for Eternity, the author talks about a traditionalism, which I've heard that years back, a traditionalism innate in European society and thus innate in the United States. Within that traditionalism, they try to go all the way back to the Aryans. But I think they do themselves a disservice because they don't have to go back to the Aryans. Traditionalism could find a lot of the inspiration for how white folks are acting presently in what's called the Middle Ages. And I see the connection. You know, I see the connection. And I hope, read the book, War for Eternity. It's wow. It's better than you even think you think it is. It's really a good book. For those of you who think, you know, as I'm talking about this, oh, you're explaining them, but, you know, it's almost like you're giving them an excuse. I'm not. I'm unpacking what this is because you have to understand, patriotism is not something that you overcome. You either have to change the way that you view the entire world, or you do things that are destructive to it, even when you think that you're doing what's right. I mean, it's a hell of a spell. It's a hell of a spell. And the messed up thing is, so, you know, chivalry was something that you sometimes had to be indoctrinated in, you know, 700, 900, 1,000 plus years ago. But, man, patriotism is just something that kind of is given to you in America. Which brings me to the next point. When I spoke about people having to do what was necessary to make this country, to eke out their way, to build this country, and to be in a position of success in this country, they really see themselves as uniquely special compared to other people who aren't them. And the reason they see themselves as uniquely special compared to other people who aren't themselves isn't just because they're selfish. No, that comes back to chivalry. That comes back to chivalry. Basically, if you were strong enough to make it, Darwinism, then you deserve everything that you can get your hands on, and nobody deserves to take it away from you. Now, granted, look, you and I, those of you listening to this, you know what gave people the opportunity, hate that word because it's used way too much, but gave people the benefit of living a comfortable life. It was the New Deal. It wasn't the wealthy. I mean, granted, yeah, FDR was kind of wealthy, but it wasn't the wealthy. It wasn't their hard work. It was radicals, communists, socialists, anarchists, social workers, black folks, red people, yellow folks, brown people, everybody who this small group of chivalrous patriots basically hate, putting their boot next to the throat of the government and the wealthy and saying, you're going to work for us or we ain't going to work for you. And we got way more than you have. And that changed the direction of the country. For a patriot who buys into this concept of American greatness, and they all do, it is impossible for them to conceive the idea that the institutions that helped them the most were not authoritarian, but were welfare creating. It is almost mentally painful for them to consider this. And I don't say this as a person who's like, oh, there's something deficiently wrong with these people. No, I have had enough conversations in the last 15 years with people who are considered heavily right-wing and brought to them facts that they could not dispute. I'm talking about some of these arguments went on for days. And I watched the pain appear on their face as they hid consciously and psychologically and emotionally from the realities that I was presenting them, which often led them, and I mean, this has occurred even since I've been in my new community. This hiding rendered them incapable. It rendered them incapable of seeing anything but pain. And finally, you know what they usually always said to me? Not all of them, but the majority, and I mean the vast majority, you're talking 90 plus percent. You have a right to believe what you believe. I have a right to believe what I believe. That is the chivalrous code. You can believe whatever you want to believe. I'm going to believe this, and if you get in my way, well, we'll see who comes on top for that one. Because for the chivalrous person, they are the last defense. They are last line of the defense, you know. After everyone else is done, they got to be there to protect what is there. The country, the institutions, whatever. Deep, though, deep in that, and I know I just switched from patriotism to chivalrous because it's very much connected, but deep in that is this myth, is this core myth. And, you know, I was thinking about this a couple of years ago, and I wanted to do produce an episode on reincarnation and the kind of social ills that is caused by reincarnated residue, stuff that we remember from past lives that just keep coming with us. And I wanted to do that because I was reading an old book that I had on reincarnation, just a couple of chapters out of it. And in the book they mentioned, the author mentioned, it was actually like three authors. They were all PhDs, by the way. But they mentioned the idea that, you know, Edgar Cayce, I don't know how many of you are familiar with him. He used to be called Sleeping Prophet. The guy could go into trance and find brilliant information out about individuals and help them to heal themselves, either physically, emotionally, psychologically. But they mentioned the fact that, and I had forgotten about this, I had read several Edgar Cayce books years ago, that Edgar Cayce would often tell people, you know, there's like 10 lifetimes that are playing into this one, but there were two or three that are really impacting this one. And it was the composite of energies that occurred throughout those lifetimes that impacted the person the most in the present lifetime. And this was before World War II. And possibly even before World War I. I know definitely before World War II, but maybe not before World War I. I know he was born in the late 1800s. Anyway, that is something that is often overlooked. And even he talked about that. We learn things, and again, this society does not do a good job of thinking about this. We learn things in a lifetime. And we take that with us as we move through other lives, depending on what we have to learn. Some people, and I've met a few people like this, they are so afraid of death that when their body dies, they just stick around until they can get a new one. And I know that sounds crazy, but it's not. There's a reason why indigenous people throughout the world used to do rituals to cleanse areas after death, because they wanted to make sure that they sent the spirit of the person along to the afterworld, so they didn't hang around and they could have their rest before coming back. Because if you don't rest, you become bogged down in old stuff that doesn't allow you to kind of do the things that you need to do in a lifetime. Moreover, if you're just sticking around, you technically don't have a life plan. You're just kind of winging it. And that doesn't always work out well. In fact, it rarely ever works out well. Now, so far as I could tell, I've only seen a couple of books that try to really tackle the idea of collective karma and how individual karma and individual incarnate residue impacts the society. I've only seen a couple of books like that. There's probably way more now, hopefully. And I know I've seen a couple of dissertations written about topics that are similar to that. Now, I have to back up a little bit here because I kind of jumped a section. In thinking about this idea that a person could die, or a body stops working, the spirit lingers around until they could find a new, you know, a new vessel, which it's not difficult. You know, most people don't realize, but when a person gives life to another person and that being is developing in the stomach, that body isn't always committed to another soul. Oftentimes, because we are so mindless when we're creating life and having sex, it's a fun time. And so you have a vessel without a person that's committed to it. Now, it changes if you have in your astrology chart. If you have the potential to be pregnant in a period of time and you get pregnant, then usually, according to karma and other factors, you will find a spirit that's attracted to that body. And that spirit will already be pre-committed to it according to what was in your chart. Most times, though, when you're just having fun and you mistakenly get pregnant and it's not in your chart and it's not in the other person's chart, that body can be inhabited by any spirits that are close to the development of that body. And, you know, it's a crapshoot. It's a crapshoot. So, considering, and I wanted to go through that a little bit, because considering the history of this country, and particularly when it comes to European Americans, white Americans, and the trauma, T-R-A-U-M-A, that they themselves have experienced, not only in Europe, but over here, that they have inflicted onto other people, the idea of hell, which a lot of them who are Christians believe in until they want to do some dirty stuff, it is not inconceivable, at least to me, that you have a lot of souls that have been just making it throughout the last 200 years by jumping bodies. They haven't gone home. They haven't resolved any issues that they have. They've just been jumping bodies, hoping to stay ahead of whatever punishment they're afraid of getting. Now, it doesn't have to always be like that, but from a spiritual standpoint, I've met a few people who, fit that category. That said, even those who do get to go home, whether you call it heaven, whether you call it the ancestral realm, depending on what level they ascend to, and why they're coming back, they can still pull in old habits that really they should have let go a long time ago. And I think that's what gives patriotism its sting. A lot of these people remember what they did to secure their place here in the United States, and to climb the ladder here in the United States. I often wonder how many white people actually have dreams of past lives, and how many of them block those dreams out because it shows them the type of stuff that they did to get to the point in their development that they're at right now. I mean, I have no doubt that karma plays a huge role in how one sees America and how one sees patriotism. I have no doubt. Moreover, I think because of this connection to karma and the myth of America, which has been alive since the United States, soon to be United States, was colonized, I think because that myth has been held on to by these people who came here, by Europeans, I think from a very deep spiritual sense, white folks have a hard time giving up that myth, because if that myth isn't true, that means why they came here, whether it was 100 years ago, 300 years ago, 500 years ago, why they came here wasn't what they thought it was. I mean, think about this. Out of all of the groups of people that have connections to their cultural past, white people are probably the only group that really truthfully hides from the reality of the things that have happened in their history. And I used to believe that they just weren't aware that they were, you know, they had forgotten. But I'm to the point in my life now where I'm like, no, they deliberately don't want to see it. Because once you see it, you have to acknowledge the truth. And the truth is not pretty in this case. At the heart of patriotism is this myth. And if that myth isn't true, then that means not only is this life put in question, but for some people, you have 15, 20 generations that are now put in question. I mean, even going back to the Moors conquering Europe and pushing Europe into the Renaissance and the fighting against that took place because of the people in Europe who wanted to maintain their power even though they weren't doing anything good for their societies. This is a deep, deep wound, in other words, y'all. And I know many of y'all got off the boat when I hit, you know, reincarnation. I was like, I don't know, what is this fool talking about? I can't listen to that. But, you know, people, it's time that we stop fooling around about this. You know, we don't have one life to live. We have multiple lives to live. And thankfully, this new generation understands that. They're not ignorant about it. And I think that baby boomers are finally starting to understand that and not be ignorant to it, you know? Reincarnation impacts a lot. And if it didn't, then we wouldn't talk so much about holding on to what was in the past. I really, now, in conclusion, y'all, I do want to say this. I really do believe that if we are going to see patriotism correctly, one, we can't be foolish about it. I don't believe patriotism is a good thing. I don't believe patriotism is a good thing. I think that people want to see it as a good thing. Oh, it's just simply dedicating yourself to your country. No. It's way deeper than that. It's way deeper than that. And obviously, you know, people will disagree with me, and I'm, you know, whatever. Cool. But there are things in history that have a stigma to them and an energy with them that we are going to have to resolve. And that means either understanding the overall negativity and destructiveness of the thing and thus getting rid of it, or ensuring that people use it in the proper context. Patriotism, I think, is one of those words that we're going to have to do that with. People who lynched black folks and massacred Native Americans, stole their land, they saw their actions as being patriotic. Male and female. Women who said, y'all gonna let that N-word do me like that? Saw it as their patriotic duty to rally the white men, and this was white women doing this, to rally the white men to go into black communities and to take care of business on their honor. And when you look again at chivalry, honor is a huge portion of it. I meant to mention that earlier. Honor is a huge portion of it. When people in present day talk about the troops going over and fighting, it's an honor thing. Patriotism is connected deeply with the honor concept, to say nothing about protecting our way of life, as you know, my conservative military friends say. I'm protecting the way of life over here. Okay, you're Roman, because that's what the Romans used to say. They conquered other people to protect their way of life. They stole from other people to protect their way of life. Yeah, well, it was also gluttonous. The Romans basically wanted to be gluttonous. And so they went and they conquered other people so they could be gluttonous. Oh, whatever. Okay. Patriotism is not going to be reformed. But understanding what it is can help us reform the society. I understand. Look, it's an argument that's going to be had, but it's what it is, y'all. This is important. It's what it is. It is very important. I think I'll end it there. Thank you guys very much. Again, if you can afford to just 5, 10, 20, guys, you know, I know there's some folks who can afford 50. Give monthly. I want to be able to put these out every week. I'd like to be able to do, you know, 6 to 8 of these a month. So if you can give, please do. Again, $CWB podcast. That is for my Cash App. And CWB podcast, that is for PayPal. Okay? If you would like me to set up a P.O. box, do me a favor. Go to radio4all.net. Click on the show. There's a contact there that you can hit me up. Just send me and say, look, I'd like to send you money via check or money order. So, you know, could you get a P.O. box? And as long as I get 5 or more people who want it, well, maybe 10. I'll do 10. If I get 10 or more people who want it, I'll do it. Okay? I'm really starting to turn the corner with monetizing this podcast because I like doing it. And, you know, I really, in the next 6 to 12 months, I want to put some oomph in this. I want to start doing deeper dives into a lot of things. And like I said, my goal is 6 to 8 of these every month. But I won't be able to do that until I can secure at least, I'm thinking 2,000 to 3,000 a month. And that's just because living expenses and I have a book list, and once when I start getting those books, they're not cheap books, but they're necessary books. So once I start getting those books, you know, I'm going to take this up another level. I want to thank you guys. Questions, comments, concerns, you can always reach out to me. I am your brother, Vymir Adis. I'll see you on the next one. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alive.